thank you very, very much, Corrado. I didn't tell you that we studied together at the University of Toronto.
Well, I'm glad to see you made something of yourself.
Well, as I ran away from you, I did. Okay. Well, we used to play golf together, too, and we were terrible.
Once.
That explains the running.
Yeah. I would like to explain just... as a way of introduction, what am I talking about today? Because when Corrado called me, and being a good friend, I was very reluctant to accept because I was in the middle of reducing a 40, 50 page, it was a two-part lecture on the relationship between text, words, text, and images, and how they travel. This was a few years ago. One of my colleagues from the University of La Mancha discovered that this is what I was doing. She found out that I was also working on Portuguese and Spanish authors. In fact, in Spain and in Portugal, there's an entire industry on neo-historical mystery novels, and especially dealing with Templars and dealing with a lot of related topics. And in those years, also it came out about 15 books on Christopher Columbus. And why he is the son of a Jewish merchant, why he may be Portuguese, not even Italian, etc., etc. So I was working madly on his work. They found out in Spain, they invited me, I gave these two lectures. I have these 40, 50 pages now that I'm trying to reduce. And I said, I don't know, Corrado, I may be busy. I was also very busy finishing what should have been my last chapter of my book, because as Norma knows, every year somebody calls, would you contribute to one of your articles for our anthologies? I did it for Norma, Fontanella, and other people. So my book is never finished. And I'm sick and tired of Eiko asking me, is it finished? Is it finished? Is it finished? Well, I don't think so, because I always work on something else.
At
so today,
at least Eiko talks to you.
Well, you should. I've dedicated 40 years of my life. So anyway, some of the slides that you're going to see later on, actually, you will see what I'm talking about, how texts and images travel. Because I'm going to focus on a few book covers of Foucault's Pendulum. But I'm also going to show two slides on Thomas Pynchon. And, well, there's a surprise later. So, readers who have followed Eiko's novels from 1980 to the present may not be surprised to read that his sixth novel, The Cemetery of Prague, has incited some polemics. The name of the rose in Foucault's Pendulum has seen in Italy a variety of criticisms from the conservative right, the Vatican Papal Osservatore Romano, and traditional Marxist critics, accusing Eiko of cynical relativism, anti-clericalism, writing literary divertissement under the influence of American postmodernism, showing off his erudition and collaborating in marketing ploys for selling millions of copies of his books. After the publication of Foucault's Pendulum, some critics began to repeat that many buy Eiko's novels, but very few read them. Romanzo comprato, ma non letto. That's the motto of Umberto Eiko. Norma knows because she reads the same papers that I read. However, soon after the semiotician medievalist and specialist in mass communication appeared on the cover of the weekly L'Espresso as l'Eco Fenomeno, the phenomenon, Eco, huh? Critics began to speak of the Eco effect, literally the spin-offs. Some people called it Il Caso Eco, L'Effetto Eco, but it's really the spin-offs. And of course, the biggest spin-off is Dan Brown, the first three novels that he has written, Angels and Demons and Da Vinci Code. And incidentally, part of this lecture on images and how text travel was from my lectures on Dan Brown, about four lectures that I gave on the images in Dan Brown. But anyway, so he had become the most sought-after Italian intellectual and opinion maker, and of course his novels were imitated all over the world. In October of 2010, immediately after the publication of The Cemetery of Prague, this is where I'm supposed to do my own work, right? And it doesn't work.
Here we
go. Immediately after the publication of The Cemetery of Prague, a bizarre criticism was launched at Eiko. Professor Lucetta Scaraffia, I've heard it also on Italian TV the other night, Scaraffia, so I thought it always was Scaraffia. at least her brother calls her Scarafia, a history, that's usually a good sign, a history professor who writes for the Vatican paper L'Osservatore Romano, Riccardo Di Segni, chief rabbi of Rome, and Professor Anna Foa, a reporter for the Jewish paper Pagine Ebraiche, suggested that in the cemetery of Prague, although unwillingly, Eco flirts with anti-Semitism. Ambiguity and anti-Semitism were first mentioned, I can't see anyway, so it doesn't matter. Ambiguity, I just wear glasses, I'm going to look intellectual. Ambiguity and anti-Semitism were first mentioned by Anthony Burgess in 1989, you heard the dean mention it. In his excellent review, not entirely free of skepticism, it was called A Conspiracy to Rule the World. He could have written for the Cemetery of Prague. Same title. In fact, Burgess spoke of Foucault's pendulum in exactly the same terms that are applicable to the Prague Cemetery. I'm going to read it because it's amazing. Six lines. This is Burgess. Now, I can't speak with a British accent, so. Still Capozzi reading. What? Then I'll sound like Froggy. For a while, it is not a novel in a strict sense of the word. It is truly a formidable gathering of information delivered playfully by a master manipulating his own invention, in effect, a long erudite joke. The world, as we know, is full of conspiracy hunters. Sometimes the conspirators are the CIA, sometimes the makers of Coca-Cola, or all the Jews, all the Catholics. The ultimate conspiracy synthesizes all possible conspiracies, il complotto dei complotti. And one wonders what precisely they are complotting against. No matter. A plot is a structure, a semiotic fabrication. In some of the European papers, Mr. Eco has also been called anti-Semitic, a charge that has been thrown around irresponsibly about many authors. The accusation probably stems from his resurrection year of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which naturally form part of the cosmic conspiracies. So this is 1989. Now remember that his latest novel is entirely, almost entirely, on the Protocols. With the Prague Cemetery, some readers do not appreciate Eco's narrative strategies of applying intertextuality and polyphony in a montage of the already said. Accuse them of plagiarism. Be careful. In 2004, so we're talking about 8 years before this novel came out, but I mean really what he talks about in 2004, you're going to see really talks about himself from 1989. Eco defined the combinatoria della creatività, the combinatorics of creativity, and quoted Blaise Pascal. His pensée septième goes like this. Qu'on ne dise pas que je n'ai rien dit de nouveau. La disposition des matières est nouvelle. Basically, in my Italian translation and then into English, goes into, one cannot say that I have not said anything new. The arrangement of the material is new. And that's really Eco from the beginning to the end. In so doing, he was clearly responding to those who were criticizing his montage of the déjà vu. I'm staying out from the word bricolage because I've eliminated from my paper Lévi-Strauss and the whole concept of bricolage, and Eco is the master bricoleur of the 20th century, as far as I'm concerned. Begin with the name of the rose, of course. Two of these alleged misappropriations in a cemetery pointed to Norman Cohen's warrant for genocide and Giuseppe Cesare Abba's diary novel, Da Quarto al Volturno. Abba, like the novelist Ippolito Nievo, who died in a mysterious shipwreck, had followed Garibaldi on his expedition during the War of the Italian Unification. However, Eco has often spoken about Cohen, and in novels he has clearly mentioned the writer Abba. In other countries, and especially in France, the Prague Cemetery has been praised by reviewers, and perhaps as a result of the polemics incited in Italy, on the back cover of the English translation, there appears a blurb signed by the well-known writer and longtime fighter of anti-Semitism, Cynthia Ozick. A recute statement warns superficial readers who may not understand Eco's irony and may misunderstand the message of the novel. I quote, "A j'accuse is always timely, but there has rarely been anyone to write it until the advent of the falsely demonic Umberto Eco, a Zola posing as the devil. His is a satanically dangerous novel, as are all ironic tales, especially if they should fall into the hands of a naive reader. So, naive readers, country bumpkins, gullible gapers, keep away. This magnificently sly, scarifying, circuitous history beside a jape is meant solely for the wise, for the intrepid, for the righteous." Olsak's words are pertinent to our discussion. She distinguishes naive readers from sophisticated readers and alludes to Eco's familiar art of writing double-quoted narratives directed at different levels of readers. Eco has spoken about the strategies of double-quoting and has explained how and for whom he writes in essays collected in On Literature and in a more recent collection, Confessions of a Young Writer. From his first novel, Eco has been constructing... By the way, even a title that he chooses, he's always winging at you. Of course, it's James Joyce, which is the first author that he falls in love when he was writing even the history of the Middle Ages. But anyway, from his first novel, Eco has been constructing ingenious possible worlds loaded with historical, philosophical, theological, and semiotic inquiries, with at least two types of model readers in mind. One, erudite, that is, more knowledgeable of intertextuality, intratextuality, metafiction, semiotics, and literary theories. And the other, more familiar with different elements of popular culture, ranging from comic books to music, theater, films, and TV shows. This, however, does not imply that one category excludes the other, because in Eco's narratological strategies, is taken into consideration, just as Leslie Fiedler did, the importance of crossing a border and closing a gap between the two cultures. Indeed, Foucault's pendulum is Eco's most intellectually engaging narrative, written with allusions to French cultural gurus like Foucault, Barthes, Derrida, and Jacques Lacan, and to philosophical and literary theories that were in vogue in the 70s and 80s. Nonetheless, the novel can also be appreciated as a suspenseful mystery fiction about the Grail, Templars, Masons, coded messages, search for knowledge and power, conspiracy theories, secret symbols, and overall as an entertaining postmodern pastiche of popular culture. It's not that I'm thirsty, I have to keep my throat wet because otherwise my cough comes and then I'm going to run out. And I hope that my good friend Norma didn't think that I was choking at her paper. The Prague Cemetery has been described by a wide variety of viewers. I loved her paper. By a variety of viewers as being challenging, confusing, too long, ambiguous, compelling, heavily loaded with dates, details, and long lists. And rightly so, as a novel about hate, anti-Semitism, forgeries, and conspiracy theories. These labels, except for the anti-Semitic issue, are essentially true of all of Eco's novels. With his sixth novel, Umberto Eco has once again shown his coherence in exploiting the intricate webs of intertextuality. I'm referring to his rhizomatic network of references to other texts, as well as his practice of making clever intratextual allusions to his own novels and essays. We heard this morning. In my own reading, as soon as I encountered in the opening chapters names and topics such as Piedmont, Paris, Guizmont, Fog, Templars, memory loss, Feuilleton, and a search for identity, my immediate reaction was, here we go again with Eco's intertextual references to Foucault's pendulum, Baudolino, and the mysterious flame of Queen Anne. By the way, I had the Cemetery of Prague 2 months before it came out because Eco sent me the text, gave it to my favorite student who has to finish her thesis. And immediately I said, oh, great, you're rewriting Foucault's pendulum. He doesn't answer. For the last 30 years, I know, when Eco doesn't answer, just says, don't ask that question again. A As I'm about to discuss, in addition to the fact that at least six chapters of Foucault's Pendulum refer to a conspiracy linked to the nefarious hoax, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, there are several narratological and structural analogies that link these two novels. The Prague Cemetery is essentially a sequel of Foucault's Pendulum, but unlike Foucault's Pendulum, where satire, irony, and parody accompany the fabrication of an outlandish conspiracy called The Plan, in Cemetery, there are some moralistic issues that readers must consider. In Pendulum, the fabrication of a bad joke hurts mainly Casaubon and his friends. In a Prague Cemetery, the concoctions of the protocols and those responsible for the forgery have hurt millions of innocent people. Simonini's lies and deceits are not funny. They are despicable. Simonini is in part a fictionalized characterization of the Russian journalist and political activist Matvei Golovinsky, who operated in Paris for the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret service organization. Incidentally, in the appendix and in several interviews, Eco has stated that Simonini is the only fictional character in a novel. The other characters are all real historical figures. He's absolutely right, except for three minor figures that appear in a novel. And I don't have time to show them, but he invents three other because they're needed in a secret bombing and then in a secret killing of Ippolito Nievo. But because I'm not touching the Italian Risorgimento, I won't go into these other figures. Furthermore, whereas Foucault's Pendulum is a sharp comical satire of gullible and naive individuals who fall for falsehoods, revisionist history, misinformation, propaganda, and paranoia, the Prague Cemetery is a bitter, ironic criticism of people, regardless of their intelligence, who in need of an enemy or of a scapegoat, choose to believe in conspiracies responsible for their misfortunes and for all the evil in the world. In short, they choose hate over love. But in a final analysis, we agree that in both novels, Eco uses satire, parody, and irony as instrument for serious discussions. Now, I need a break, so I'm going to show some slides. These are part of, as I said, my work. I want you to see the first cover. This is October of 1980. And I don't have the article with me. Immediately, those who accused them of plagiarism did a research. And that particular figure, remember I showed before Eco stand-in says that? That particular figure comes from three other book covers, two in Portugal and one in Spain. Now you understand, I did my research on how I became the Sam Spade of Ecoville. Look at what happens in a subsequent edition. You notice the sfumatura, and you notice that things have changed. The birds are still there, by the way, but the wall has changed a little bit. It's beginning to look a little bit more mysterious. Look at the English translations and foreign translations. Now we go into, the top hat in the 19th century. And of course, it's one of the narrow streets of Paris, or it could even be London, it doesn't matter. But look at what... Does anybody read this? If it's what language it is? I don't. Czech? I think it's Czech. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Check. Look where the birds have gone from the floor. Fantasy.
Well, they make him look like a Fantomas character.
But now he's facing towards the readers. Okay? So, in my research, I went and I looked at the Portuguese cover, and one time he's looking at the wall, another time he's looking at the reader. So, the metamorphoses are very interesting.
It's interesting about that too. That covers it's got French in the book as well.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Now, let's go to these other two. Here's the original English translation. Now, look at what we have here. Of course, we have a gargoyle, huh? So, of course, we're going to go with Paris because that's where 70% of the novel takes place.
But the gargoyle is actually like a wolf over Europe, and what the imminent, you know, the wolf is going to eat the sheep.
Right.
You know, and then, of course, you have a little bit of landscape. Well, so this is the standard English translation. Look what the British do. Remember those birds flying around in the previous one in Spain and in other countries? They're still flying around, but now...
Swirls.
It's the musical version.
It's coming. Soon it will be in Toronto. On stage.
And look how big his last name is.
Yeah. That's true.
Look at what happens to Umberto Eco's I Foucault. So this is the original Italian cover when it came out in 1988. By the time Dan Brown has become famous, and of course decrypting and decoding and all that, look at what Italy does. Okay, I'm going to give you also what the novel is about, the decoding and decrypting symbols and archaic symbols and all that. I can't spend too much time because I'm already... But look what he did with the English translation. That's the original English translations in North America. Well, this is how he signed my book, and that's how he always... It's the only book that doesn't have funny words, Turocco, The Rock, and whatever. And here it's just Umberto swinging on his own banjo. So you see then what I'm saying about how text and images travel and they influence one another, of course. But it's interesting now, this is what Jeanette would call the paratext. So before you enter the text, you already know what the novel is about. Or at least the paratext makes you curious to read the text. But that's another story, Corrado. Among his many fields of research, Eco has a long record of studies on fakes, forgeries, falsehoods, hyperreality, conspiracy theories, and on the importance of history and memory. All of his novels are excellent proof of how he narrates his encyclopedic competence. As a further indication of how Eco works on the topic of conspiracies, I suggest reading La Sindrome del Sospetto and Una Bella Compagnia. These are two of his Bustina di Minerva. These are the articles that he publishes in L'Espresso. Now it's biweekly. They came out in 2007. They came out 3 years before the Prague Cemetery. In these two articles, you have all the elements of his novels. She came and asked me before, and I explained that Eco has been doing that for years. A couple of years before the novel comes out, he's already talked about his novel, and then immediately after the publication of his novel, he talks about some of the characters and some of the elements. This has been his technique all along. In fact, one could have already predicted that after The Name of the Rose, that was his strategy. Because he hadn't written Name of the Rose, so we didn't expect him to use this technique. But I'll say more later. So anyway, they were both written while he was composing the Prague Cemetery. It is worth mentioning that Foucault's Pendulum was published in the midst of numerous novels, essays, and movies dedicated to conspiracy and conspiracy theories. For example, a year earlier, Richard Donner, Conspiracy Theory, was produced by Mel Gibson, was produced starring Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts. Oh, this was the last of the cover of Foucault's Pendulum, and you notice how now the emphasis is on the Templars. Again, it was part of my lecture on the Templars. So this, for those of you who remember this movie, remember he's a cab driver who suffers of paranoia, and he has conspiracies about the CIA all over the place. Some of them prove to be true. But this, to me, is the real anxiety of influence of Umberto Eco before writing Foucault's Pendulum. And it's Thomas Pynchon, The Crying of Lot 49, and even Thomas Pynchon, who, by the way, always stays out of the public scene. Look at what happens to his cover. His original cover. I'm not a symbologist. I'm not Robert Langdon from Dan Brown. But, you know, I could spend my life trying to interpret that sign. Look what pop culture does. Come on, this is San Francisco, the Flower Children. You got everything, the Beatles. But then the title, a bizarre Saturnalian flood. So you got orgies, you got everything there. Okay. Gravity's Rainbow. Here's the original cover. Look what happened a few years later. Sex and War.
That's the British cover.
Yes, that's the pink cover. Very good. You spot it right away because you know the British covers. I have an entire series of the Picador on Moravia. And I used to take the elevator every morning and go to the third floor. You've been to our campus. And Norford Fry would take the elevator with me every morning. And I would come up, because I was teaching Moravian translation, with Moravia's novels. And of course, the very first one, she's covered. And as we go on, she's more and more naked. By the time we get to Attenzione, you have pornography 100%. So Fry said, look, I've been watching you for a long time. What the hell are you teaching in my college? Said the Bible. He likes the Bible. Well, he liked it. However, it is essential to recall that in Italy, through the 70s and 80s, by the way, this don't count for part of my presentation, okay? I'm stealing minutes. Not because I have to read what I wrote. Otherwise, the trip from Toronto wasn't worth it. However, it is essential to recall that in Italy, through the 70s and 80s, existed a widespread cynical attitude called dietrologia. Dietro means behind. So, essentially, a syndrome of suspicion and paranoia that asked what lurked in the background of several killings, suicides, kidnappings, and chain of scandals involving business magnates, politicians, the Italian government, and a Vatican bank. Therefore, it is not a surprise that in a novel, among several social-political references to Italy, we read about Aldo Moro's execution on May the 9th, 1978, and a bomb explosion in the train station of Bologna on August the 2nd, 1980. So he documents, more could be said, but we heard the previous paper how he documents history. For the preparation of Foucault's Pendulum, Eco had done intensive research on the Hermetic tradition, esoteric texts, Kabbalah, and the Torah. His encyclopedic competence and his skills in entertaining while teaching produced an erudite intertextual divertissement that functions like a cognitive tool. The driving dynamic cognitive process present in every one of Eco's novels brings to mind the definition of science by Charles Sanders Peirce. I quote, "A sign is something by knowing which we know something more." A sign is something by knowing which we know something more. If we substitute sign with the word text, we understand how Eco puts into practice epistemological concepts of Charles Sanders Peirce and Immanuel Kant on perceiving, understanding, and interpreting science and reality. Indeed, by knowing Eco's texts, we get to know a lot more about many topics, including logic and mass communication. Furthermore, Foucault's Pendulum and the Prague Cemetery are perfect illustrations of Eco's remarkable art of docere et delectare, applied in engaging narratives that force the reader to ask, what does Eco really mean? We recall that William of Baskerville, in The Name of the Rose, tells Azzo, books are not made to be believed, but to be subjected to inquiry. When we consider a book, we must not ask ourselves what it says, but what it means. And Jonathan, maybe you can help because you're the expert on poetry. I mean, my reading of Ezra Pound is like the Les Neiges d'Autun in Eco. They're gone. Ezra Pound, if I well recall, a paper that I never finished writing, his belief was that the beauty of a poem is not in what it means, but how it means, right? I was not able to find, you know, that aphorism of Ezra Pound, but I always thought that Eco, you know, incorporates those beautiful thoughts.
And the bricolage, of course, was Pound was a great editor of Eliot's Wasteland.
By all means.
So the technique you're talking about is something a bit like
very much so. Thank you. History, memory, and the importance of the past are key recurring topics in Eco's novels. We were there all morning long. All grounded in periods of history characterized by changes and issues that continue to concern our society. I like the way you quoted that.
Thanks.
I'd forgotten that. I should mention that in Eco Studies on History and Memory, as it is most evident in the novel Queen Loana and his scholarly, La Memoria Vegetale, we recognize several classic studies on memory, as well as more recent ones, such as Francis Yates' The Art of Memory, Lina Bolzoni, The Gallery of Memory, and Paolo Rossi, Passato, La Memoria, L'Oblio. But I believe that it is the work of his colleague, best friend, medievalist, Jacques Le Goff. His book is called History and Memory, appeared in Italy in 1977. This book, by the way, you can find it in English. It's in just about every library. It is a text rich in discussions of ghosts of the past and history of the present. How befitting for Eco. It's this book, as far as I'm concerned, that may have had a major anxiety of influence on Eco as he adventured a year later in the arena of novel writing. Remember that he starts writing in 1978. However, to quote Casaubon and Bilbo and their ironic refrain, let's not digress too much. Casaubon, Eco's Bakhtin, as he admits, I loved the polyphony of ideas. And he explains the importance of one's past and the concept of docere delectare this way. Brilliant, two sentences. Quoting from Foucault, I believe that what we become depends on what our fathers teach us at odd moments, when they aren't trying to teach us. We are formed by little scraps of wisdom. When I was 10, I asked my parents to subscribe to a weekly magazine that was publishing comic strips versions of the great classics of literature. My father, not because he was stingy, but because he was suspicious of comic strips, tried to beg off. The purpose of this magazine, I pontificated, quoting the ad, is to educate the reader in an entertaining way. By the same token, in a Prague cemetery, Simonini reiterates several times how he was conditioned from his childhood by his anti-Jewish grandfather, his anti-clerical and Mason father, by the dishonest lawyer, the forger Rebaudengo, by scheming Jesuits, and psychologically by the young Jewish girl who ridiculed his sexual advance. Chapter 118 of Pendulum begins with a quote from Karl Popper's Conjectures and Refutations. The conspiracy theory of society comes from abandoning God and then asking who is in his place. Later in a chapter, Casaubon mentions G.K. Chesterton and his alleged famous aphorism. I had to cut out the entire two pages here on why it's an alleged aphorism. This is a whole battle still going on the internet. How come nobody can find it in Chesterton? Did Eco invent it? Well, turns out to be that Chesterton was quoted two other authors, and he came up with that aphorism, but Chesterton doesn't reveal his source. So it's, again, the Sam Spade and of literature. Later in a chapter, Casaubon mentions, this is Chesterton. When people cease to believe in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. As we recall, the three protagonists, instead of using common sense, as explained by Leah, end up believing in their plan, which had started as a joke. And unfortunately, it is their own powerful, uncontrollable, and dangerous golem, a Frankenstein, that kills all three of them. Diotalevi is dying of cancer, Belbo is hung in the Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers, and Casaubon, in the closing page of the novel, is waiting for his killers in the hills of Piedmont. Karl Popper's words and Chesterton's aphorism about God are applicable, in my estimation, to Eco's belief that when people lose sight of history, rationality, and reality as a whole, then they believe in anything that our society of images and spectacle permits and presents to us. Guy Debord, The Society of Spectacle, La Société du Spectacle in 67, Eco, Travels in Hyperreality, and Jean Baudrillard, Simulacra and Simulation, have examined how today we fuse and confuse much too easily the real with the artificial, the virtual and the simulated. Again, Casaubon, Belbo, Diotalevi are protagonists and victims of a fictitious plan that attracts lunatics and fanatics who fall prey to conspiracy theories dating back to the Knights Templar. Initially, the three protagonists, just like Keiko, were concerned with the proliferation of esoteric texts like the Baphomet of Pierre Klosowski, the Illuminati trilogy by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson, and the Holy Blood and Holy Grail by Lingen, Bajant, and Lee. My God, I have been neglected in my second job. So, here's the original The Illuminati trilogy. You can still pick it up. It's still a bestseller. Well, I don't know. People like to read 1,011 pages, but... And here's the second edition of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. The only thing that it's added here is the secret history. And then I think... No, it doesn't. But it says that it's revised and edited with images, the second edition. Oh, okay. So I don't have to do it for the next. So don't look at it. These are three key texts among the numerous writings that have generated a plethora of mystery novels dealing with coded messages, secret societies, mysterious symbols, and infernal plans for controlling the world. The thrilling adventures of James Bond, who fights global criminal organizations like Spectre, and Indiana Jones and his globe-trotting sagas in search of a variety of holy and powerful grails, come to mind mainly because allusions to James Bond and Indiana Jones are present in Eco's novels. But we must also take into consideration how many neo-historical novels dealing with Templars, metaphoric grails, the Bible, and the art of deciphering coded messages have appeared around the world in the last three decades, and how often on a dust jacket of these novels we find references to Umberto Eco and Dan Brown. So the slides that I showed you before were dealing with this issue. In Italy, worth mentioning are two novels. One that came out soon after Pendulum, we're talking about 6-7 months later, on Templars, a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful novel, by the journalist and historian Franco Cuomo, Gunther of Amalfi, Knight Templar. It's absolutely beautiful. I think it's been copied by several other authors, including one of Richard Curry, who wrote on the Templars most recently, and it was also on TV. The other, the bestseller Q, 1994, an historical thriller about spies and conspiracies during the Protestant Reformation, written by four writers using the pseudonym Luther Blissett, now known as Wu Ming. Q is of particular importance because for a while some critics in Italy believed that it had been written with the help of Umberto Eco. They were convinced that because Eco was still teaching in Bologna, that his students, all four of them, students at the Dams, they actually got together with Eco, and it was one of these ménage à cinq. So, once again, look at what... And again, we're talking about four gentlemen who hate publishers, and they put all of their novels on the internet, because that's okay if they don't get too many copyrights. They believe that literature is for everybody. So this is their original... English translation, a great novel, one that tells us about ourselves and how we came to be here, as if we're all sons and daughters of the Protestant Reformation. But I like this one. Thriller, novel of ideas, the cult. That's what I like best. Because, of course, Foucault's Pendulum is cults, ideas, and all that. So, again, it's fascinating how publishers will work on a paratext, you know, continuously. And if they're going to launch, they're going to republish their book, they make sure that the cover will speak loudly. I don't know if you're all familiar with this. Authors have nothing to do, except for Italo Calvino. Authors do not choose their covers. Moravia tried it for about 30 years until it became a bestseller in Italy. He would submit all these covers, and they were all rejected by the Bompiani. And finally, he would submit three or four paintings because he wanted an art image on his covers, and they start choosing. So it's fascinating that you have people there in the graphic and in the managers and that work only on this. You know, it's just like the posters for movies, right? The director couldn't care less, but somebody has to brainwash you with the proper poster. I'm going to skip a little bit. Yeah, let's not digress too much. So, in Fictional Protocols, the last chapter of Six Walks in the Fictional Woods, Eco outlines a brief history of the protocols and provides a diagram that illustrates the evolution of the document. Now, all of you are familiar. Oh, see, you should have done this for me. Forget the slide. This is the one. Okay, here it is. This appears in Six Walks. So he's able to summarize in one diagram the whole history of the protocols. After he has dedicated 6 pages, these are the Norton lectures at Harvard. So he does this, gives the diagram, and he points out that some people have never accepted that the document is a forgery, even though it was categorically labeled as a fake in 1929 by the London Times journalist Philip Graves. Eco quotes Nesta Webster, whom he had mentioned in Pendulum, in reference to anti-Semitism in protocols. I am going to read the whole quote, even though it's 7 lines, because I think it's extremely important, and we're going to see how this relates to the next quote. In 1924, Nesta Webster, who devoted her life to supporting the story of the unknown superiors and the Jewish plot, wrote a book called Secret Societies and Subversive Movements. She was aware of the Times revelations and knew the entire history of Nihilus, Rakowski, Goethe, and so on. She was ignorant only of the connections with Dumas and Eugène Sue, which are my own discovery. Here is her conclusion. The only opinion to which I have committed myself is that whether genuine or not, the protocols do represent the program of world revolution. And in view of their prophetic nature and their extraordinary resemblance to the protocols of certain secret societies in the past, they were either the work of some such society or of some profoundly versed in the love of secret societies who was able to reproduce their ideas and phraseology. This is what we call circular thinking. Webster's argumentation may sound absurd, but it is similar to a bitter truth that Eco recalls in Useless Learned Explanations. I love it. This appendix. Useless Learned Explanations in a Prague Cemetery. Listen to this quote. Very brief. How much the whole existence of this people is based on a permanent falsehood is apparent in the famous protocols of the Elders of Zion. Every week the Frankfurter Zeitung whines that they are based on forgery. And here lies the best proof that they are genuine. When this book becomes the common heritage of all people, the Jewish peril can then be considered as stamped out. It's a quote from Mein Kampf. Yeah, it's a quote from Hitler. By the way, some of the Mein Kampf lines are actually in the opening chapter of the novel, but not all of us will be able to recognize because he has mixed about 30 different quotations in the opening chapter. Foucault's pendulum abounds with freewheeling connections, often accompanied by ironic statements reflecting what the three protagonists are doing, such as better to rewrite the books of others, which is precisely what Simonini does in A Prague Cemetery. In both novels, we detect eco-cynicism in seeing history as an accumulation of falsehoods and forgeries from the days of Homer and the donation of Constantine and the relics in the Middle Ages and a war in Iraq. A cynical view in line with Karl Popper and his statement from Conspiracy Theory of Society. I quote, "The belief in the Homeric gods, whose conspiracies explain the history of the Trojan War, is gone. The gods are abandoned, but their place is filled by powerful men or groups, sinister pressure groups, whose wickedness is responsible for all the evils we suffer from, such as the learned elders of Zion, or the capitalists, or the imperialists." Now, I'm quoting Popper because I firmly believe that on a philosophical level, The Pendulum of Foucault and the Prague Cemetery and Prague Cemetery shows Eco agreeing with Popper in his notions on truth, falsehoods, falsifiability, objective knowledge, ignorance, history, and conspiracies. Let us consider another statement of Popper from On the Source of Knowledge and Ignorance, and see how it relates to the philosophical discourse that Eco wishes to have with his readers. I quote, "Knowledge, the possession of truth, need not to be explained. But how can we ever fall into error if truth is manifest? The answer is, through our own sinful refusal to see the manifest truth, or because our minds harbor prejudice inculcated by education and tradition, or other evil influences which have perverted our originally pure and innocent minds. Ignorance may be the work of powers conspiring to keep us in ignorance, to poison our minds by filling them with falsehood, and to blind our eyes so that they cannot see the manifest truth." End of quote. I must add that this is an argument that runs through several essays in Eco's Turning Back the Clock. I'm referring to Eco's writing on how and why we repeat mistakes made in the past. Foucault's pendulum, in my estimation, shows how Eco is combining the Borgesian Library of Babel with a Deleuze-Rizomatic network of associations and connections within a universal encyclopedia of knowledge. You notice I left out unlimited semiosis of Charles Peirce because it's been discussed by Norma, it's been discussed, but that would be what a page and a half would have followed. We recall that the modus operandi of the three protagonists as they fabricate the plan is to connect, confuse, and construct. Casaubon states, the idea is not to discover the Templar secret, but to construct it. Two of the most recurring verbs throughout the novel are, in fact, to construct and to connect. And so, Casaubon, 176 for those who care about statistics. And so, Casaubon, Belbo, at least in the Italian edition, I'm not sure, because then when you translate, you have synonyms running into play. And so, Casaubon, Belbo, and Yotalevi proceed to combine esoteric texts, historical facts, science, and Kabbalah. But by allowing their imagination to run wild, they lose perspective of what is real and what is fiction, and confuse a shopping list with a coded message. Consequently, they become like Colonel Ardenti, Aglier, Professor Bramanti, and the Diabolics. They, in fact, become like the lunatics that they had initially ridiculed. Belbo. I have to say this. Eco. Tired of being interviewed. Have you read the Da Vinci Code? Have you read The Angels and Demons? He says, yes. Dan Brown is one of the characters in Foucault's pendulum. Yeah, I used to write and believe in this, you know. Anyway, Dan Brown, wherever you are. Belbo summarizes what has happened as he confuses the sin of having abused unlimited semiosis and hermetic drift of meaning. This is what he says. I am dying because I convinced myself that there was no order. And this sounds like William of Baskerville in The Name of the Rose. That you could do whatever you like with any text, Derrida, De Man, and everybody else. I'm dying because we were imaginative beyond bounds. This is just one clue that Foucault's pendulum also deals with literary and philosophical theories associated with post-structuralism and deconstructionism. Maria Corti and the poet Antonio Porta were among the first reviewers to suspect that Eco was targeting literary theories in pendulum. And as we know, soon after Foucault's pendulum, Eco explained his disagreements with deconstructionists in The Limits of Interpretation and Interpretation and Overinterpretation, insisting that whereas a text can have many meanings, it cannot be used to say what it does not want to say. And at the same time, he was reminding his critics of his previous studies, The Open Work and The Role of the Reader. As I mentioned before, the Prague Cemetery is rich with intertextual elements. This part, I'm going to read it, although I was going to skip it, because I think it's interesting if we're going to look at analogies of structure. Because as Jonathan said this morning, I really appreciate that you said that, Eco starts very briefly, just like Maria Corti and Cesare Sager, as a structuralist, but he abandons structuralism immediately with La Struttura Assente, that we still don't have the complete translation. And, of course, he embraces semiotics and becomes a master of that, which is going to remind me to ask a question about the norm and to you later. But he never really abandons structuralism per se. He focuses on structural architecture, of course, structure, and creating a cosmological world. Structure is important. So to some extent, even Levi-Strauss is important. The problem is that then they abuse, you know, trying to fit everything in a superstructure, and that's the problem. So let me skip a little bit more. As I mentioned before, the Prague Cemetery is rich with intertextual elements that recall Foucault's pendulum. For example, we have the topographical description of Paris, the city sewers, the city planner Haussmann, satanic cults, orgiastic rituals, Barouel, Simonini, and of course the innumerable names and writings associated with the concoctions of the protocols. This is all in pendulum. Equally interesting are the narratological strategies that link these two novels. I mentioned, for example, the mixture of three voices. That of the first-person narrator Casaubon with those in a free and direct discourse of Bilbo and Yuta Levi. Three split selves of Eco himself. He splits in three voices. That of the first-person narrator, I think we can understand. Casaubon is the omniscient. But the interesting part is Bilbo, which is very Eco-like. And, of course, Eco is winking at his critics because they were accusing him of having written Name of the Rose with the computer. And he said, all I had was a lettera 24. So he still typed it. The graphic appearance of the text also draws our attention. From the opening pages, we notice different fonts used for the epigraphs, digressions, quotations, and above all, for Bilbo's files from the computer Abulafia. In terms of structure, the three of the 10 sephirots serve as the main frame for the 10 sections of the novel, made up of 120 short chapters, each chapter beginning with at least one epigraph from a vast variety of texts. These are some of the elements that underline the nature of a fragmented and decentered narration that does not follow a linear and chronological sequence of events. And we recall that Casaubon reconstructs with flashbacks and digressions numerous events starting from when he first met Bilbo in 1972. But whereas the time frame of the entire story covers two decades, the time frame of Casaubon's recounting of the fabrication of the plan covers 4 days. June 23rd, June 27th of 1984. In a Prague cemetery, which is unmistakably written and structured like a 19th century feuilleton containing drawings and images that portray scenes and characters from the novel, Eco revisits the 19th century, the age of great fiction writers that he loves, such as Dumas, Hugo, Eugène Sue, and Manzoni, as well as the age of revolutions and socio-political turmoil in Europe. Here too we find three narrative voices. Those of Simone Simonini and his split self and alter ego, Father Dalla Piccola, written in the first person, and a third-person narrator who attempts to put order to the chaotic bits and pieces of the diaries written by Simonini and Dalla Piccola. But the anonymous voice of the narrator is similar to that of the author when the appendix explains the difference between plot and story and outlines the chronology of historical events referred in the diaries. In a novel about spies and counter-spies, it's befitting that the narrator should behave like a spy on behalf of the reader, as he reads and comments on the diaries. Just as important, each voice appears in a different font. As we have seen in Pendulum, structure, graphic appearance, digressions, flashbacks, and numerous quotations accentuate the montage of a decentered narrative. Furthermore, the time frame of the novel, extended from 1830 to 1898, is narrated in Simonini's and Dalla Piccola's diaries, dating from the 24th of March to the 19th of April of 1897, literally just over a month. In short, in both novels, a large time frame is reconstructed by a narrator who recalls in a short period of time a myriad of events in order to understand the dilemma facing him at the beginning of the world, memory. course, comes in. And this must be noted, the self-reflexive references to the act of writing and narrating are obvious. In the same way that from the opening chapters, we notice metanarrative clues and self-ironic and semi-autobiographical allusions to Eco's practice of constructing possible worlds which are machines for generating interpretations. I'm getting to the end. I know some of you are... The gamut of immoral deeds of Simonini, a most reproachable and attractive ruthless scoundrel, begins with his forgery in his hometown in Turin and continues with his long chain of deceitful involvements with Garibaldi's expedition, the mysterious death of Ippolito Nievo, spying in Paris during the French Revolution, the attempts on the life of Napoleon III, the Dreyfus affair, collaborating with French, Prussian, and Russian secret services, working with Leo Taxil, and with his role in the concussion of the protocols by exploiting literature and French promoters of anti-Semitism like Édouard Drumont and Alphonse Toussnel. Unlike his predecessors Baudolino, Belbo, Casaubon, and Gnambo, who excel in the art of forging, remembering, and narrating, Simonini lacks scruples and morality because he has no consciousness of being evil. He is a chameleon-like character that resembles a mixture of Zelig and Forrest Gump, the fictional characters popularized by the film Woody Allen and Tom Hanks. And Eco loved both movies. He is too fictitious to be real, and yet very real because he characterizes real people who have engaged in all sorts of evil doings. Simonini hates everybody, Germans, French, Italians, and especially women and Jews, regardless of the fact that, from his own admission, he knows very little about women and Jews. Also, he may collaborate with Father Bergamaschi, but he hates Jesuits. In fact, just as the Jews and the Masons, in the novel the Jesuits are stereotyped and criticized for their art of scheming and plotting. The caption under the image of three Jesuits summarizes very well Simonini's feelings inherited his anti-clerical, from his anti-clerical father. I hope this is the right one. The Jesuits. Jesuits are Masons dressed as women. Now, it's true, though. There are several Jesuits in several images of the Jesuits in the novel. And there are also severed, almost cartoon-like of Jews. But I chose the one from La Libre Parole of Drumont, from one of the historical documentations, where you see that all of Europe is under the Jewish plot. And then, of course, the other one, that's really from his grandfather, who says, "I dreamt about Jews every night for years and years." This is the cemetery of Prague, the setting of a chapter from Goethe, Biarritz, which is a plagiarism of plagiarism, which I will briefly mention in a minute. I thought I'd show the slide because otherwise I'd forget it. And I'm saying that throughout Pendulum, we recognize comical statements in situations related. See, what I'm saying here, the page that I'm skipping, is that we have to differentiate the type of humor that he uses in these two novels. There's humor in both novels, but you cannot assume that he uses puns, quips, winking at the reader, parody in the same way. He doesn't. Throughout Pendulum, we recognize comical statements and situations related to how the ultimate imaginary conspiracy originates with the Templars and continues with Paulicians, Bogomils, Cathars, Patarenes, Albigensians, Masons, Jesuits, Jews, and so on. Bebo reminds his friends, "The Templars have something to do with everything," a sentence repeated three times in one chapter. In the same fashion, throughout the Prague cemetery, Simonini insists that it's important to show that the Jews have something to do with every conspiracy. So, ergo, those two slides. However, there is very little humor in the intriguing concoctions of the protocols, because we are confronted with a moral issue dealing with truth and lies, and are aware that this infamous document promotes hate. We may find some dark humor in a surprising chain of influence and plagiarism extending from Dumas to Sue to Maurice Joly to Goethe to Golowinski, but I feel that there is no humor in learning about the evolution of anti-Semitism in France, beginning with Barouel, Mémoire pour servir à l'histoire du Jacobinisme. continuing Goetz's fabrication of the meeting of the Jewish leaders in the Jewish cemetery of Prague in his novel Biarritz.
By the way, there's a beautiful, beautiful page that describes the chaos of the cemetery. Now, these are real photos, obviously. They're not. And this is the chief rabbi, Lowe, the man who wrote the first Golem. But what is interesting, and the reason I chose this photo, I have about 20 photos, is that Eco shows how the concoctions of the protocol is such a confusion of texts. You really can't even identify anymore. You know who's who. You cannot identify who is buried in these slides. They're just like that. He is a master at taking an image and then the thought that follows, or the thought and then the image. In Six Walks in Fictional Woods, Eco pointed out that research on Dumas and Eugène Sue may explain even further the possible genesis of the protocols. Later, in his introduction to Will Eisner's graphic novel, The Plot, The Secret Story of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, he reiterates the role of his research and underlines the moral and intellectual implication beyond the reception of a document that continues to attract attention. However, I feel that I like to think that Eco, in his introduction to Eisner's, is an indication of his strong support for comic books. Remember the quote from Foucault's Pendulum, and graphic narratives such as Art Spiegelman's Mouse. So here's the plot that he writes the introduction. Here is the two volumes of Mouse. Some of you may have it at home. Just brilliant graphic novels. They illustrate, just as is Queen Loana, how they can be excellent popular techniques for remembering our history. Now, normally I would have quoted, but it's half a page and we're all tired. I would quote from the introduction. It is a fascinating page and a half. The only thing I'm going to read is the opening line. The most extraordinary aspect of the protocols of the Elders of Zion is not so much the history of its inception as that of its reception. In a closing line, in other words, it is not the protocols that produce anti-Semitism, it is people's profound need to single out an enemy that leads them to believe in the protocols. And now the real conclusion. Eco's masterful mixture of erudite scholarship, intertextuality. I skipped my favorite slide. Okay, I'll show it at the end. Eco's masterful mixture of erudite scholarship, intertextuality, historical backgrounds, and fascinating stories have frequently been labeled as postmodern neo-historical fictions, the theme of today's colloquium. I have often referred to his multi-layered narratives, thank you, Norma, as encyclopedic hybrid fictions containing several interpretive possibilities. Norma said he's repeated about 8 times in 8 different articles. We agree with Eco, and it's true. We agree with Eco that his novels are all double-coded. They are not easy readings. And because they are instruments for discussing, understanding, and expanding knowledge, they function as cognitive tools that activate associations of words, images, ideas, characters, historical events, cultural phenomena, and innumerable texts. Eco loves to assemble narratives that focus on truths and events from the past that are still present today. His novels appeal to readers who, in addition to parody and irony, enjoy hunting sources and intertextual allusions. While reading his encyclopedic novels, one is tempted to connect to the internet, to the electronic universal library, as he defines it in The Infinity of Lists, in order to acquire more knowledge about all sorts of names, dates, and titles. Inquisitive readers willing to learn more will appreciate taking inferential walks outside of Eco's text and into the labyrinths of libraries and encyclopedias.
And we'll certainly enjoy reading Eco as much as Eco enjoys writing his novels and winging at his readers. Normally, that's where I would have ended my lecture. But then I have a tiny, tiny little conclusion to the conclusion. I read Eco for breakfast, supper, and but this just came out before coming to St. Catherine. In really closing, I like to quote a witty meta-narrative statement from the Prague Cemetery. It's only one sentence, so I'm going to miss it if you're not paying attention. Certainly, the papers your narrator is browsing are full of surprise. It might be worth using one day as the basis for a novel. And so, in his playful game of mirrors, we see Simonini advising Dalla Piccola as he winks at the narrator acting as a reader of the diaries, who winks at the author Umberto Eco, who is winking at his readers for recognizing a familiar metaliterary motif that he exploited in The Name of the Rose, when Azzo, recognizing his own life in the various pages of the books that he was leafing through in a library, realizes that all of those books are telling him de te fabula narratus. This story is about you. Thank you. Sorry for taking so much time.
Thank you very much.